This is DJ Lotto, and what you just listened to, it was Who Am I Going to Share All of This Wine With by The Garden, and before that was In the Net by Penalty Kill, and I'm afraid that we are almost, okay, well, we are completely up with all the music I have to play for you guys today. Well, this was Mind's Eye. You're listening to KDVS Davis, 90.3 FM, and up next we have
Books and Ideas.
Books and Ideas by DJ
Safikar.
I keep forgetting, but stay tuned for that if you would like. I hope it's really exciting, invigorating. Yeah.
Do you wanna?
All right. It's 90.3 KDVS. Good afternoon. This is a public affairs show called Books and Ideas. I am DJ Safikar. We are broadcasting not far from where the village of Putatoy once stood, inhabited by Patwin Native Americans. This is the fourth and final week that we're looking at the sound of a wild snail eating, The Earthly Adventure of a Woman and a Gastropod by Elizabeth Tova Bailey, first published in 2010. Okay. We are at chapter 15. We're hoping to finish that book today. Okay. Chapter 15 is called Cryptic Life. In this chapter, Bailey looks at gastropod defense system. She admits, "My initial surprise and learning about gastropod defense systems quickly turned to respect. Whatever one's family and species, the world is thick with danger, and my snail needed all its active and passive defenses. But the survival methods of one type of animal may seem strange to another." Bailey discovered snail-eating predators come in all forms, from mammals of all sizes to amphibians, birds, and various insects, including ants, centipedes, beetles, and tinier parasites. Even a few species of spider sometimes resort to dining on escargot, despite getting a face full of mucus. Some of Elizabeth's snail defense systems were so subtle, she hardly even noticed them. Of course, it's simple. Withdrawal into the shell not only provided physical protection, but also gave the appearance that no one was home. While a snail's slow locomotive speed makes it seem more vulnerable, it may actually be a survival method. Saving it from predators who are hunting activities can be triggered by fast movement. The silence of the snail's gliding also protects it from those who hunt by sound. Yet, as Bailey points out, being slimy is perhaps its most complex defense system, which goes well beyond the ability to simply repel Homo sapiens. Bailey writes, "Large predators can get a grip on a slippery creature, and smaller parasite insects may get stuck in the ooze or have their mouth part gummed up. If the usual slime recipe isn't enough of a deterrent, a special batch with particularly toxic and bad-tasting chemicals can be copiously produced on the spot. For a gastropod, survival of the fittest often means survival of the slimiest." Bailey notes that another well-evolved passive defense is the easy way her snail's earth-colored shell blended into its environment. She is continually impressed by how the snail can vanish right in front of her eyes, lost amongst the territorium's flora even when it's moving. Bailey concludes this chapter writing, "Everything about a snail is cryptic." And it was precisely this air of mystery that first captured my interest. My own life, I realized, was becoming just as cryptic. From the severe onset of my illness and through its innumerable relapses, my place in the world has been documented more by my absence than by my presence. While close friends understood her circumstances, those who did not know her well found her disappearance from work and social circles inexplicable. Yet, Elizabeth writes, it wasn't that I had truly vanished. I was simply homebound, like a snail pulled into its shell. But being homebound in the human world is a sort of vanishing. In this chapter, Bailey looks at, this is chapter 16, I'm sorry, Affairs of the Snail. In this chapter, Bailey looks at sexual reproduction of the snails. Woodland snails are hermaphrodite. While rare among mammals, this characteristic is common in the majority of other animal groups and in the plant world kingdom as well. A snail may find a partner randomly or show a preference for age or size. They mate in late spring, early summer, or fall, after an elaborate and complex courtship. A terrestrial snail that has been isolated for a while can, rather conveniently, self-fertilize, thus founding a new colony and ensuring the survival of its own genes. Elizabeth writes, one morning I looked into the terrarium and was surprised to see a cluster of 8 tiny eggs. They were on the surface of the soil, just under the edge of the birch log, and were the color and the size of the pearl tapioca. She wondered if they would hatch and watch with interest as the snail visited the egg site every few days to tend to them. On several occasions, she writes, the snail appeared to hold each egg in its mouth for a while to slime it, or so I presume, and thereby keep it at the right moisture for hatching. A romantic encounter between a pair of snails can take up to 7 hours from the start to finish and involve 3 phases. First, there is a lengthy courtship in which the snails draw slowly closer, often encircling each other, smooching and exchanging tentacle touches. If they find they're not quite to each other's liking, they may easily end their romance. But if things are proceeding well, then in some species, a shooting dart occurs. In the second phase, the snail embrace in a spiral direction and mate. Some species of snails simultaneously swap sperm, while others will be male or female at a particular mating and then reverse their roles the next time. Apparently, being a hermaphrodite is not always easy. If 2 snails of a species that take on gender roles want to be the same gender simultaneously, a conflict may occur. Regardless of the method, and assuming all goes well, sperm is exchanged either internally or externally, depending on the snail's species. It may be offered in elaborate design and decorated packages called spermatophores. Consummation is followed by the last phase, resting. The snails, still quite near each other, both withdraw into their shells and remain immobile, sometimes for several hours. Regardless of the mating method of a particular species, fertilization occurs internally. Often, the lovers have parted. After the lovers have parted. Sorry. Elizabeth speculates that her snail probably encountered a romantic partner either early in the spring or sometimes during the prior year. The lack of predator and the provisions of large portobellos and a steady water supply were just the encouragement a prospective snail parent needed to go ahead with egg laying. Eggs are usually laid below ground in several clutches of 30 to 50 each. Elizabeth's snail may have laid so few eggs and kept them above the ground because the conditions in the terrarium were slightly too wet. Burying the eggs in such circumstances might have been unsafe. Bailey and the snail established a certain routine. But one morning, when Bailey tried to search for the snail, As usual, it was hard to find. But after looking in all the usual hiding spaces, it seemed to have vanished. Elizabeth had now covered the terrarium, since it was the home of Elizabeth had not covered the terrarium. Since it was the home of a living, breathing creature, she thought ventilation was important. As far as she knew, the snail had never before left the terrarium. She thought she might be able to follow its slime trail, but then she was too weak to get down on the floor to search for it much further. As the hours passed, the situation seemed more and more futile. Elizabeth was suddenly met with the realization that she was almost more attached to the snail than to her own tenuous life. She writes, "There's a certain depth of illness that is piercing in its isolation. The only rule of existence is uncertainty, and the only movement is the passage of time. One cannot bear to live through another loss of function, and sometimes friends and family cannot bear to watch. There were times when I wished that my viral invader had claimed me completely." She continues, "Illness isolates. The isolated become invisible. The invisible become forgotten. But the snail kept my spirits from evaporating. Between the two of us, we were a society all our own. And that kept isolation at bay. The snail was missing, and as the day waned, I was bereft." Chapter 18, Offspring. That same evening, Bailey was expecting a visit from a friend who had traveled a long way to see her, but all she could think about was the missing snail. When her friend arrived, she was able to look closer in the terrarium and lifted up a piece of moss. The snail had dug a hole and had laid another, much larger clutch of eggs. The conditions in the terrarium had become more favorable for egg laying. The snail had burrowed under the moss and deposited its eggs where they would be well hidden and stay evenly moist. Elizabeth was surprised to learn that she was the first person to have recorded observation of a snail tending its eggs. Most malacologists assumed when a snail visited its egg, it was more likely to eat them than to provide care. Since the first clutch was laid in the surface of the soil and the numbers so few, Elizabeth could see that none of the eggs were missing after the snail's visit. In the wild, revisiting eggs could give a predator a fresh trail to follow, but her snail was free from those concerns. Elizabeth noticed that because her snail had done so much egg laying, it had lost a noticeable amount of weight. For about a week, it spent more time than usual sleeping, and then it began to eat mushrooms ravenously. Bailey did not witness the first clutch of eggs hatching. She thinks it probably happened at night. Since it was the morning that she first noticed some of the original eggs had disappeared, and when she looked closer, she saw a few tiny snails moving around. They were so small that if they hadn't been moving, she wouldn't have detected them. Young snails emerge in a bubble-like translucent shell. She noticed her hatchlings like to hang out on the underside of the mussel shell, probably because of the moisture, darkness, and the available calcium. She wondered how soon the little snails would mature and watched them closely. The thought of ending up with some 100 or so fertile snails was a bit mind-boggling. It was an outcome best avoided. Elizabeth could only guess at the total number of offsprings, as they were impossible to count. By day, each one had its own hiding place, and at night, they were out and about, moving around in all directions at once. While watching her solitary snail had been peaceful and calming, watching a plethora of its young in simultaneous motion was hypnotic. She has to admit that she's just a bit overwhelmed. The last part of the book, called Familiar Territory. Chapter 19 is called Release. By midsummer, Bailey's health had returned enough for her and her dog Brandy to move back home. She writes, "It was hard to say which one of us was happier. She was used to the familiar eccentricities of her old farmhouse, and this made her transition easier, although she admits the adjustment to less day help was more difficult." Bailey missed the companionship of her original snail, but the time had come to return it and its young to the wild woods. She hoped that by fall she would be managing well enough that a single of its remaining offspring might come and stay with her for the winter. Snails with the longest lifespan are often found in the most rugged climate. Given New England's deep winters, her snail would probably live several more years. That would mean it would have further lengthy courtship and additional generation of offsprings. After its sheltered life in the train, the snail would have to readjust to the challenges of the wood, the dangerous predators, and the unpredictable weather. But Elizabeth was convinced that with the snail's many methods of defense and dormancy skills, it had survived before, and she felt certain that it would do so again. She wished that she could have attended her original snail's release, but now that she was at home, she was just too far away. A letter arrived from her previous caregiver describing how she chose one offspring and left it in the terrarium for Elizabeth and carried the original snail and the rest of its brood back to the place in the woods where it had first been found. Bailey writes, "The original snail and I had been fellow captives, but now we had both returned to our natural habitat. As I try to make my life more livable within a few rooms of my house, I wondered how the snail was coping in its native woods." Elizabeth writes, "Even though I was at home, I was still not free from boundaries of my illness. I thought of the terrarium's limited space and how the snail had seemed content as it explored and fulfilled a life cycle. This gave me hope that perhaps I too could still fulfill dreams, even if they were changed dreams." Next chapter is called Winter Snail. Once Bailey was settled enough in her home, her snail's single remaining offspring came to keep her company. She writes, "This time the terrarium was a huge antique glass bowl with a 48-inch circumference. It created a wonderful green spherical world. The juvenile snail was about a third of the size of an acorn. It took to sleeping during the day inside a hollow, rotting birch branch, which provided a perfect dark, damp hiding place. Occasionally, Elizabeth would use a flashlight to look in and check it out." As the days grew short and the winter's cold stillness descended upon the land, Elizabeth thought of the wild snail hibernating beneath a snow blanket, snug in their burrows. Inside Elizabeth's house, the weather conditions were quite different. The oil furnace kept the air warm and dry. Instead of digging a hole and hibernating, her young snail evisted for several weeks at a time. It would either disappear inside the hollow birch branch or dangle upside down from the underside of the polypody fern. When it woke, it would eat mushrooms and soil, drink water, rasp at the inside of the mussel shell for minerals, and then it would head for the dark birch hollow and climb back up in the fern frond and estivate again. Elizabeth writes, There was a paradox of speed in relation to distance and time that began to intrigue me. In contrast to its slow locomotion, my snail's life cycle was quick. In 70 years, it could produce 70 generations compared to 3 generations a human might produce. Although the snail moved more slowly than a human through the physical world, it traveled more quickly than a human along its pathway as an evolving species. She continues, my snail's quick life cycle also brought to mind a paradox within my own human world. Okay. While some aspects of society, such as technology and communication, were continually speeding up, and other aspects, such as healthcare, moved at a pace even slower than snail, during the months I had waited for the appointments, underwent tests, and tried new treatments, my original slate laid its eggs, hatched its young, and was returned to the woods, and then in the late fall went into hibernation. As the winter months passed, Elizabeth notices a change in her snail's watching behavior. She writes, the previous spring, when I could do almost nothing, spending time with a snail had been pure entertainment. But as my functional abilities improved just a bit, watching a snail began to take patience. I wondered at what point in my convalescence I might leave the snail's world behind. Elizabeth writes to one of her doctors, I could never have guessed what would get me through this past year, a woodland snail and its offspring. I honestly don't think I would have made it otherwise. Watching another creature go about its life somehow gave me the watcher purpose too. If life matters to the snail and the snail matters to me, it meant something in my life mattered, so I kept on. Snails may seem like tiny, even insignificant things compared to the wars going on around the world or a million other human problems, but they may well outlive our own species. Okay. Chapter 21. Spring Rain. As the spring rains came and the weather warmed, Elizabeth noticed the young snail awoke, climbed down from its fern fraud, and became active again. It would soon mature. She believed the time had come to release it into the wild so that it could establish its own territory and search for a mate. Bailey recognized that her life without the snail would be different. She knew she would miss its quiet presence and the time she spent watching it, but she thought the spring showers would ensure an ample supply of fresh food, giving it the best chance of survival. She writes, hatched and raised in a terrarium, the young snail had been served the finest portobello mushrooms and fresh water in a blue mussel shell. It had never encountered the dangers that lurked in the woods. It would have to survive on its own ingenuity, and I hope that it would find its own home, its new home, an interesting and delicious place, both familiar and very surprising. Elizabeth could now occasionally manage to walk a short distance from her house to the edge of the woods. One evening, after a light rain had turned to drizzle, she carried the young snail to a spot beneath some large hardwood trees, backed by a stone wall. She placed it gently on the ground, watching as it came partway out of the shell, its tentacles lengthened, twitching with interest as it moved them this way and that way in response to the abundance of fresh odors. It explored some dead leaves, some dark green moss, a bit of lichen, and a big root of a tree. She watched it glide slowly through the dusk and vanish into the dark. For the first time, the snail was in a world without boundaries. Bailey's concluding chapter is about night stars. In each of the parts and the chapters of Bailey's book, she offers a small quote that is meaningful to the chapter. This chapter begins with the following quote. Humanity is exalted not because we are so far above other living creatures, but because knowing them well elevates the very concept of life. That's from Edward O. Wilson from Biophilia in 1984. Thanks to this nail, Bailey had learned to establish a new life rhythm. As she slowly got better, she was able to do small things like sit outside in the garden with Brandy by her side. She learned to appreciate life and slow things down. She writes, "We watched the sunlight find its way through the branches of the crabapple tree, dappling the blue squill and crocus, and we looked for the pointed noises of the tulip leaves as they emerged in their perennial beds. Each week, more flowers came into bloom, and the hedge that bordered the garden began to fill with nesting birds. I could close my eyes and feel the sun warm my whole length and the wind ruffle its way over me. My ears filled with the dozy hum of bees and those tiny and old insect sounds that rise up all around, the sounds of mingling in my mind with the good, deep smell of earthy life." Elizabeth writes, "Soon spring turned to summer, summer turned to fall. The snow came. The snail and its offspring were still much in my thought. The original snail had been the best of companions. It never asked me questions I couldn't answer, nor did it have expectations I couldn't fulfill. I had watched it adapt to changing circumstances and persevere. Naturally, solitary and slow-paced, it had entertained and taught me and was beautiful to watch as it glided silently along, leading me through a dark time into a world beyond that of my own species. The snail had been a true mentor. Its tiny existence had sustained me." Late one winter night, Bailey records in her journal, "One last look at the stars and then to sleep. Lots to do at whatever pace I can. I must remember the snail. Always remember the snail." All right, we're going to find you now a song to play us out. Okay. All right. I believe. Thank you.
You're listening to KDVS Davis, 90.3 FM. The following views presented in this hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. Up next, The Smile Show, after these messages.
Parental involvement is the key to your child's success at school. This is Eric Hines, president of the California Teachers Association. Whether it's volunteering at school, communicating with teachers on a regular basis, or helping with homework, we know that parental involvement is crucially important. So get involved. Working together, parents and educators can make this a great school year for every student in California.
A message from the California Teachers Association.
Doctors Without Borders delivers medical emergency aid to victims of war, armed conflict, natural and man-made disasters, and to others who lack health due to the social or geographical isolation. Doctors Without Borders is a private nonprofit organization which needs your help to bring primary health care to remote, isolated areas where resources and training are limited. For more information about Doctors Without Borders or to volunteer overseas, visit the website at www.doctorswithoutborders.org.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Sleep Foundation recommend that adults get between 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night. Studies show that getting consistent sleep can regulate mood and is related to learning and memory functions. The National Sleep Foundation recommends maintaining a regular bed and wake time schedule, exercising regularly, and avoiding caffeine close to bedtime. If you'd like more information and sleep tips, visit sleepfoundation.org.
Community. Well-being. Empowerment. Welcome to this week's edition of The Smiles Show and Podcast Smiles. Join our host, Jimmy Smiles, as we connect virtually. And now, here's Jimmy.
And here I am, already back for another edition, another round, another fun time with you all here on this week's edition of The Smiles Show. Of course, I'm your host, Jimmy Smiles, and always glad to be with you here on the air and in the air. And last few days, we've been dealing with a lot of moving air. I'm recording this, but it's quite windy out, to be sure. So we're definitely into the fall season now. Exactly. It's definitely a windy time.